Life is a quest for logic and reason. It is a quest to find balance between science and faith. Life is a quest for knowledge and understanding. But most importantly, it's a quest for personal discovery. Whatever your quest, knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom. Welcome to Quest. Hi, Amber. Welcome to the Quest podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm excited to get to talk to you today. This is one of those rare podcasts I do that actually comes out the same day.
Oh, cool. That's
so awesome. When we're done with this today, I'll be editing it and it will be going live. So it's really a very current one. Normally, I'm booking these interviews like months in advance. But with you, I have you right at the time where I want yours to come out, awesome. which is great. What part of the world are you in right now?
So I live in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah. You have a big race coming up though soon, right? Is Daytona coming up?
Yes, it is. No, not September. February 17th is our first race of the season at Daytona. So just getting all prepared for it now and really excited for it.
Well, we're going to dig into your racing career, but let's take a moment. And just for the listeners who aren't familiar with you, tell everyone a little bit about you.
Yeah, so I'm Amber Balkin. I'm from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, now living in the U.S., where I moved here to pursue my dreams as a NASCAR driver. Originally grew up racing on dirt tracks in the northern states, and I went to school for business and tried to, you know, live a normal life, but the normal life just wasn't for me. So in 2016, I moved down here to the States, and I've been pursuing my dream as a NASCAR driver and now racing in NASCAR's ARCA Menards series for Venturini Motorsports, with my primary sponsor being Icon Direct and Toyota Racing. So really, really excited for what's to come. It's been a long road to get here. I've had to overcome a lot of adversity, which I'm sure we'll get into in the show. But yeah, it's been quite the journey.
That's exciting. You began racing it actually at 10 years old, right? Did I read that somewhere?
Yeah. Yep. I started racing in go-karts at 10. I would have wanted to start earlier if I could have, but grew up racing dirt oval go-karts and then moved up to mini sprints, then 410 sprint cars, and then switched to pavement racing in 2016.
How did you get interested in racing to begin with?
So I'm a third generation race car driver. So my mom's father raced and then my father raced as well. So my parents actually met at the racetrack, got married, had me. So it's definitely in my blood.
Oh, for sure.
Ever since I knew what it was, like I was a fan and I knew that I wanted to do it myself. So it's the thing I'm most in love with in this world is racing. I love driving race cars. I love being around it. I love everything about it.
That's incredible. Now, you know, with you mentioned getting your start with like go-karts. How much of wanting to race is also knowing the car? Like, were you also one of those girls that was into engines too? Or would you just like to get behind the wheel that, you know, a car someone's already put together?
Yeah. So growing up, my dad was like, if you're going to do this, you need to pay for the go-kart yourself. You need to work on the go-kart. You need to know how everything works. So if I had it my way back when I was young, I would have just showed up and drove the car. But my dad instilled work ethic in me and made sure that I knew all the technical aspects of the car and everything that was going on. And so he had me cleaning bearings and swapping chains and changing tires and doing all that stuff at 10 years old, which now as I'm an adult, you know, I'm really grateful that that's the way he brought me up in it.
That's great. And at 16, you got your first sprint car. Is that right?
Yes. First mini sprint as the, yes.
Sure. So that was like your first real serious race car, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So I grew up watching my cousins race, my uncles, my dad, and they all raced sprint cars. My dad raced mainly dirt late models, but raced sprint cars as well. And I just wanted to be like the rest of my family and get to race what they're racing. And at that time, my parents, you know, thought that jumping into a 410 sprint car would be a big jump. So we had a series a little closer to home called the Northern Lightning Sprint Association, which were basically just a smaller version of a 410 sprint car. And I got enough sponsorship to be able to purchase one on my own. And I owned the car, I worked on the car, and it was the car was older than me. It was the oldest car that was there, but we still managed to make it to Victory Lane. So after that, I had a competitor who had a really great race car. He actually let me drive for him in the following year and won a lot of races in his car. So that's what kind of caught the eye of the NASCAR diversity program. That's when I caught the eye of my future 410 sprint car owner, and winning races will help, you know, attract the right people around you.
Sure. And most of the sprint car racing, that was in Canada, right?
So the mini sprint racing I did both in Canada and the Northern US, and then same with 410 sprint cars. It was mainly the Northern US.
Did you find you were one of the only women that was racing sprint cars? What was that environment like?
Yeah, when I raced in the Northern LS Sprint Association, that I was the only female, and there was about 30 to 36, 38 cars a weekend. There was a lot of good cars. When I raced mini sprints, it was mainly just me. There was one year where there was another girl, but I mainly was the only female.
What were the reactions from the male drivers? Do they think women should be in racing? What did you have any, were you up against anything in those days?
Yeah, when I first got into Lightning Sprints, you know, my dad had been a name locally in the series, so they kind of were aware of who I was and assumed that I kind of had everything handed to me, which wasn't the case at all. So they definitely had preconceived notions of who I was or what I could be or what I could do. And when I started winning races, it didn't help the situation at all. So there was drivers back then to this day that, you know, I've earned their respect and they do respect me because they've seen how hard I've had to work to get to where I am and also what I've been able to accomplish. But there's also a handful of drivers that don't want me there and don't believe I should be there and won't race me clean and just don't agree with me being part of the sport. But it's been like that for my whole career. So to me, it's just kind of outside noise that I try not to pay attention to.
Sure. Yeah. Is racing in Canada kind of the same good old boy type system as it is in the US?
Yeah, definitely. There's not a lot of differences between Canada and the US when it comes to motorsports, other than it's more popular in the US. But no, it's definitely the same type of culture, the same mindset around the sport for sure.
Sure. You're the first Canadian woman to win a NASCAR sanctioned race in the US in your first year racing. Tell me about that experience.
Yeah, so I moved to North Carolina in 2016 to pursue NASCAR. It was my first full season in a pavement car, a stock car, which was completely different than what I was used to. But everything I've done, I was able to win races. So I expected the same thing in this car, in this series. I had known nothing about stock car racing other than watching NASCAR on Sundays. I didn't know the difference between the limited late model or late model stock or pro late model. Like, I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I just knew that I wanted to win. So, you know, I worked really hard to learn as much as I could all year long. And towards, you know, mid season, I started getting a lot of second places and then started getting leading laps and leading races, and then finally got the win and then backed it up and won again the previous year. So it felt really good, but it was also a long time ago. So I'm just, you know, ready to chase that next win.
Yeah. Not too terribly long ago, though. You also earned, I would just want to make sure that the audience hears this. You also earned 11 top five finishes and you were a rookie of the year, right?
Yes. So I've been rookie of the year in almost every series I've raced until the Arca Menard series, which I hope to win in this coming year. But yeah, like I said, I always try to learn as much as possible, and I'm there to win, definitely, no matter what series I'm in or what car I'm driving.
You're so humbled when you talk about it. It's like, no, not a big thing at all. You just keep moving forward, right? It's great. But I mean, such great accolades for you to have those accomplishments right out of the gate is amazing. I want to bring this up. I want to hear how you handle this. In 2020, you were involved in a serious sprint car accident. Tell me about the accident.
Yeah, so 2020 was obviously a year that was very different for all of us. And I had planned to race NASCAR that year, but my sponsorships had fallen through. So my one longtime sponsor that I've had You know, we discussed, do we go dirt track racing because we can, our money can stretch farther, or do we just do a couple races in a pavement series? And we agreed that it made more sense to do more races on dirt because dirt is less expensive. So I raced what's called a dirt midget. I had only raced it once before at a big race called the Chili Bowl. It's a big race in motorsports that happens once a year. And, but with my sprint car background, I thought, you know, this would be a fun thing to do. And, our first handful of races were good, and we got into one race and, made the feature event. And, next thing you know, I was in the ambulance, and I don't remember what happened. All I know is we were in the race and my car flipped viciously over and over and over, landed in a fence. When I kind of came to, I remember hanging in the car, and then I passed out again and then came to again in the ambulance. And when I woke up in the ambulance, I couldn't feel my arms or my legs. I couldn't move them, couldn't feel them. So I thought that I was completely paralyzed. And I remember screaming to the nurses, like, I can't feel anything. I can't feel anything. And that was definitely really scary because I didn't remember what happened, and couldn't feel any of my limbs. And luckily they shot me with adrenaline. And a few minutes later, I started getting the feeling back in my fingertips and my hands, and then eventually the rest of my body. But I spent 3 nights in the hospital. I had collapsed lungs, burns to my arms, and I've had a lot of bad wrecks in racing. It's part of the sport. But
that
it was
definitely the worst.
It's definitely the worst one. I've flipped a lot, especially in sprint car racing, hit the wall hard in NASCAR. But this was the first time that made me question whether I wanted to continue to do this or not.
Did you have a concussion?
I did. Yes. I also had a concussion. It took me about 2.5 weeks before I could even lift my arms. My whole body was just kind of destroyed, to be honest. And a couple months to recover from the concussion and get my lungs all healed up and everything. But obviously I went back racing.
You know, they say, I've had some professional wrestler friends of mine tell me about when they hit their head at just the right angle, they call it a stinger, where you won't feel your arms or your legs and you feel like you're paralyzed. But what it was just a compression of that spinal cord. If you hit your head on like the roof of something, or, you know, like how wrestlers are, you know, head right into the mat, you know, and your whole body's in the air. And that sounds a lot like how they explain it, these stingers that they'll get. And they're just kind of temporarily paralyzed.
Yeah.
But also concussions too could be the same thing. You know, I think fans go to midget car racing specifically to see these cars endo and crash. Like, that's half the appeal.
Yeah.
It's like going to hockey. You kind of halfway are going there to see a fight break out, you know?
Right. Yeah.
There is definitely those people that the dark part of the business is they want to see people crash.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. But I've seen, I grew up going to races. And the little town I grew up at in Indiana was big. Salem Motor Speedway is there. Sparta in Kentucky was, you know, for a long time, a big NASCAR track. I'm not even sure if it's utilized anymore, if it's closed down, but that was a big track. And there were all kinds of dirt tracks, figure eight tracks, all in Southern Indiana where I grew up. So I was always at those race tracks, but so many times people would go to sprint car race, midget car races and things, just to figure eights, just to watch crashes.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that you were part of that. I'm curious, what's it like coming back after the wreck? I hear people tell me about the invincibility they felt before the wreck is over after the wreck. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that way? Were you more cautious? Were you a safer driver later? How did mentally did your game change after that?
Yeah, I think it's natural to wonder, like, do I still got it? Like, am I going to be nervous? Am I going to be scared to really push it? You know, that doubt definitely crept in. But as soon as I got in the car, got strapped in and did a couple laps, I was like, all right, I'm okay. I'm fine.
Yeah, that's great.
But until you do it, until you, you know, get back on the horse, so to speak, you really don't know. And that's why I think every driver does it, because it's more to prove to themselves, like, okay, I can still do this. I'm not afraid. And then the more you do it, the more you hop in the car, the more races you race, you kind of just forget about it. Like, honestly, I always forget about that crash until I do interviews and then people bring it up. But like, other than that, I kind of forget it even happened because I'm just so focused on, you know, the races ahead of me.
Injuries, I think, are part of many businesses, you know, they're not often as violent as car crashes, but that's the tool you use. A tennis player has injuries too. Yes. Many that are, you know, life threatening to their sport.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, certainly some sports are definitely more dangerous than others. Even Tiger Woods has injuries from golf, which is odd to think, but he does, you know. So when you're a serious a competitor, you're going to have problems. And it just so happens you have a very fast car that can damage you.
Yeah.
I also hear other racers tell me that they sometimes lose their edge or maybe their nerves, some when they have a family, that like kind of what they were as a single competitor versus married or having a child at home has changed their sport. Do you feel like you don't have that problem? You don't have any kids, so
I haven't gotten
to that yet, but do you see that happen with people that you know?
I don't think so. I haven't seen it firsthand. Like I'm single and don't have any kids, so I don't run into that problem. I, you know, have the ability to still be selfish, I guess you could say. But, you know, I think with age comes patience for sure. So I think some of that aggression might come down a little bit. For me, the aggression has not come down yet. Maybe when I get into my older age, I know even watching my dad, you know, he doesn't race like he used to. And, you know, he raced a lot different in his 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. So I'm sure it does change, but luckily I have not ran into that yet.
How much of racing is mental over physical or vice versa? Would you say there's a percentage you would put on it?
That's a great question. I would say it's pretty 50-50, to be honest. You definitely need to be strong and have great endurance and be focused. And, you know, there's so much we do outside, you know, in the gym and heat training and endurance training and everything we do to be physically fit for the races. But I personally think mindset is just as important, if not more important, because if you don't have the belief in yourself, in your capabilities, in your talent, then you're not going to be able to achieve what you set out to achieve. And I think having a clear mind, being focused, not only having confidence in yourself, but the people around you, your team, your race car, that all plays such a big factor into whether you guys are able to execute or not as you know, an individual athlete and as a team. So I think the mindset is as important, if not more important, than the physical aspect.
That's great. I love hearing that. Mm-hmm. I'm always very curious about mental, physical, and everything. You know, if you've ever seen my books or you've listened to earlier episodes of the podcast, I do dig in a lot with all my guests about mental, physical, spiritual, spiritual questions coming up. But I do want to ask you one thing real quick about, you know, mentally, when you're in the car, is your focus absolutely on every gauge measurement cars around you? Is it dangerous for your mind to wander? I don't imagine there's a version of Amber that's thinking about her grocery list or what she wants to buy on Amazon while she's in the car. Like, where's the mind trained to?
No, that's why I love racing so much. That's why I love driving race cars, is because it is the only time and only thing I've experienced in life that you truly get to live in the moment and be in the now. And you don't even think about anything else because your subconscious is so set in the now. And it's so intense to the point where when we race or when we drive these cars, we're driving with our subconscious. We're not even really consciously driving them anymore because there's so much happening at once. We have so many different inputs, whether it be like having to actually drive the car with our, you know, we're figuring out our feet, we're figuring out our hands, throttle control, steering input. Then we have spotters talking to us. We have crew chiefs talking to us. Then we have to feel what the car is doing and relay that information to our spotters, to our crew chiefs, so they can make the proper adjustments while driving at 190 mile an hour, while having cars all around us, while, you know, trying to avoid wrecks, figure out how we can pass the car in front of us, figure out how we can get that lap time 1/100th quicker than the last lap. And there's so much going on in that race car, so many different sensory inputs that you have to almost do it at a subconscious level, because if you were to try to do that all at a conscious level, your mind would spin in circles. So
for sure,
there's this element of just kind of letting your subconscious take over and know that your body's doing what it needs to do and feeling what it needs to feel, which I think makes athletics so magical in the first place. It's how you get into the flow is almost from the subconscious level.
Physically, I want to know what you eat, how you eat before a race, and how you hydrate before a race. Like, is there you don't want to go into a race on a full stomach. Like, how far back do you actually eat? And is it a big meal? Like, take me through that routine.
Yeah. So hydration is one of the most important aspects to our sport because we are in the cars for hours on end. I lose about 5 pounds of sweat per race. It's 140 degrees in the cars. We're wearing triple layer fireproof suits with balaclavas and helmets and gloves and boots, and there's no air conditioning in these cars, so it's really, the heat is really intense, and that's why we do intensive heat training outside as well. So to be hydrated is probably the most important thing for race car drivers. So I love Pedialyte. I drink Pedialyte beforehand. And then on race day, the one day I didn't drink Pedialyte, I was extremely sick. I was puking the entire night after the race. Didn't think I was going to make it through the race. So hydration is everything. Water and tons of electrolytes, vitamins, minerals, just everything you can do to keep your body hydrated. Sodium is huge. I started drinking pickle juice and eating salt packets, and I've tried all different things to figure out what I can do best to keep myself hydrated. And then as far as food, I'm usually not hungry on race day, which sucks because I need to eat. But I always try to, you know, at least have a breakfast sandwich, or if it's a later race, you know, have a pasta or like a chicken sandwich or something for lunch, and try to eat as much as I can. But I definitely don't eat a ton on race day. I could eat more. That's something I'm working on.
If anyone from Pedialyte is listening to this episode, Amber is available for sponsorships. Contact your people. We'll put you on the side of the car. How much of racing do you think is spiritual? Do you think there's a spiritual aspect to it? When you get into a car that could potentially be your coffin, are you saying a little prayer? Is there a higher power? What do you think about that?
I've never really thought of it.
Wow. And that's an answer. I'm just always curious. Yeah. But, you know.
No, definitely. Like, we have a preacher at the track all the time, and he prays with us beforehand, which I always love. I know my mom's always praying before my race, and I don't really ever pray for my safety or anything like that, which, because I don't want to think about that. Like, I don't even want to, I never get in the car and think of like, oh my gosh, am I going to crash or am I going to not be safe? Like, I don't even think about that. I just want to have a good day and perform to the best of my ability. So, you know, I wouldn't say like I don't pray before a race, other than with the preacher that's there and does that with us.
Did you grow up spiritual or religious?
Yeah, I'm super spiritual. I don't know how to describe. I guess more so the day before, I think about more of that. I meditate the day before and then the morning of.
That's good.
I just try to get my mind as clear as possible.
You recently had a career best finish at Daytona. What was that experience like?
Yeah, that was great. I started 37th because we didn't get to qualify, and then we pushed forward up into about third place and got shuffled around quite a bit, but then ultimately finished sixth. We had a few things go wrong with the car, which kind of hindered our performance, because I think we could have done even better.
Well, this will be a big year for you anyway. So I think we're going to see is better from you this year.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the NASCAR Drive for Diversity program. You were kind of originally noticed because of this program. Is that right?
Yes.
Let's talk about what that does.
Yeah. So the NASCAR Diversity program, main mission is to bring more diversity into the sport of NASCAR, ultimately expanding our fan base. And to me, diversity looks like being a female, but it also includes, you know, people of different ethnicities and races, and just trying to bring more inclusivity into the sport, which I think is a beautiful thing. I know that me watching Danica Patrick on Sundays definitely opened my eyes to what could be possible for me, you know, before you see it, you got to believe it. And or before you believe it, you got to be able to see it. And she really was that person for a lot of us girls. So I think it's huge to have representation in the sport of NASCAR.
You mentioned Danica Patrick. It's interesting about Danica Patrick because she sort of existed pre-social media. You know, her day, like MySpace was the thing. And to kind of, you know, kind of school everyone, kind of going back in time a little bit here on how social media sort of evolved, Facebook and MySpace were things you had to get on your computer and get on the browser and like bring up these things. So it functioned like social media in terms of how you message people and post stuff, but there were no smartphones. And that's where things really shifted, was with smartphones.
Yeah.
So Danica Patrick was incredibly popular on MySpace at that time, which was Facebook's biggest competitor. In fact, it was, I think Facebook was actually very small compared to MySpace. It hadn't even grown to be what it would become later. And Danica was everywhere. She was the spokesperson for GoDaddy. She was everywhere. I couldn't tell you how many major things that she won, if any, but you know, she was super popular and not by any regard the first female racer in different categories of racing, but one of the most popular and very attractive. And that didn't hurt her at all. I'm curious though, you know, kind of going back in time and looking at Danica's career and its trajectory and how she was handled on early social media, there are other female racers out there today. I'm not going to name any names. I think people listening to this or the fans of racing would know the names I'm talking about. But there's a lot of women, very attractive women that are racing, that I wonder if they're more into the racing aspect or the social media aspect. If they just want to be influencers and just the racing is sort of like the thing they do that they call their career, but not really serious racers. Does that make sense? Because you are a serious racer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's definitely, it's like anyone, like you can't say all 32 or 34 male drivers in the Cup Series are the exact same. Like everyone's different. Everyone has different personalities, different things that drive them, different goals they want to achieve. And unfortunately, women in racing all get lumped into one category or one box when that's not the case. You know, there are a good amount of women coming up in racing, but it doesn't mean we all see things the same way and want the same things and view racing in the same way either. We've all, you know, there's different ways we've all gotten here. There's different levels of work ethic. There's different levels of, you know, how we got here. So I think the toughest part is usually we all get lumped into the same category when that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's a weird, you know, again, growing up in the Midwest in Indiana, the Midwest, the Southeast, very popular places for racing, for NASCAR, for professional wrestling, for lots of sports like that, that appeal to a certain demographic of male. And I've seen, you know, the wrestling entertainment has dealt with this for years with women in the sport, incredibly athletic women that have trouble being taken seriously because it's a male audience. In fact, if you've ever gone to a professional wrestling event, when women come on to wrestle, they don't show this on TV. You have to be at the event to see it, but men will leave and go use the restroom during their match. Like they'll leave, like you'll see the seats empty when women are wrestling, even if they're incredibly good competitors and very popular, they still don't care. And it's really odd to me. And I think there's definitely a fan base that's very, very, very male for those sports. I think for TV, it's different with women in sports. But I think for spectators, I think the men don't like it as much. Can you speak to that? Do you think there's any truth to that? The difference between maybe at home or at the event?
I haven't really had many negative experiences at the tracks as far as fans are concerned. Mm-hmm. I've mainly had positive ones. So I guess I'm fortunate in that.
That's good.
Aspect. Yeah. I mean, maybe NASCAR.
We all want times to change.
Fans, right? So.
Yeah. Everyone wants times to change and for people to get beyond that, because there's this weird, especially in the US, there's this generational way of thinking that sucks. Mm-hmm. And people in the United States, in the Midwest, the Southeast, you know, they're a little racist because their dad was a little racist. Their grandpa was a little racist, or they're male chauvinist because that's what their dad, how they saw their dad treat their mom. Like, it's so weird. And in bigger cities, it's better, but all you have to do is, you know, not everyone's in Atlanta. Go two counties away. Tell me what the county is like, you know? And I imagine to some extent, it's probably like that in Canada, the further away you get from big cities. And, but, you know, representation is key, and you have to put representation in front of generations so people forget about how the old ways were. I think that's where we're at. And I think I very, very much respect female drivers. I think they're incredibly talented, and I am very lucky to have you on this podcast today because I'm a big fan of you anyways.
Thank you.
And, and you're the real deal, right? I didn't want to just bring a race car driver influencer on the podcast. I wanted someone who is, you know, could very likely be the next big name in this sport.
Thank you.
And eclipse names that were before you. Like, we'll never forget about Danica Patrick, but you could easily eclipse her career the way your trajectory is going. And I'm excited to talk to you about that. Tell me what your day-to-day is like. What do you do when you're not racing? What's your day-to-day like? Are you in the gym every day? How do you eat? What's your guilty pleasure? Give me all that stuff.
Yeah, I train pretty much every single day. Big into fitness, big into mindset as well. I read at least 10 pages of a self-development book every day, listen to podcasts, like meditate. I'm really into mental training as well as physical training. I do have iRacing simulator to learn tracks. We have the Toyota Racing Simulator that I got to go into the first time last week. So going to be utilizing that for sure this season. And media. Meeting with management, sponsors, appearances. I do speaking engagements as well. A lot of work. So when I'm not working, I like to play pickleball. I think that's really fun. And just kind of relax. I mean, I guess my idea of relaxing weekend would just be to go for a nice dinner, maybe have a glass of wine and just read a book or hang out after.
Yeah, well, that's great. What's the hardest part about being in the racing business? Is it chasing the money to get the sponsors to be able to make the races? Because I would think that would be what it would be.
Yeah. For I mean, it's different for everyone. Some people, you know, have the connections or have the resources to have that money right away. But for me, that was definitely the most challenging part of my journey, was not coming from money, not having that famous last name, you know, having to immigrate here from Canada and figure that all out, and not having any friends or family or really knowing anyone when I moved here. That was all really challenging, because I was kind of starting from scratch and figuring out, how can I raise all this money? How can I make connections to be with the right people, with the right teams? And you know, it's taken me a long time to get here. Like I said, I moved here in 2016. It's now 2024. So it's taken me almost 8 years to get to this point, because I've had to do it the hard way. I've had to raise all the money myself. And it wasn't until this year that I got a management team. Before, I was doing everything on my own. So it was a lot. I had to learn how to be a businesswoman before a race car driver, which I wanted to just be able to put on a helmet and drive, but that wasn't the case. So, but I'm grateful for it, because now I've acquired all these skills and business skills that I wouldn't have otherwise had.
That's incredible. That's great. Amber, you are really an amazing person, and I am very happy you took some time today to come out, and you're racing next in February at Daytona.
Yes, February 17th.
Yes, February 17th. That's where everyone can catch you at next. How can people find you out there on the interwebs? Do you have a website? Are you on social media?
I do. Yes. My website is AmberBalkanRacing.com, and my Instagram and TikTok and Twitter is all at AmberBalkan10. And if you could follow me on there, that'd be great. My partners love it. And we're going to have a great year this year. I'm super, super excited about it. I got great sponsors with Icon Direct, with a great race team of Venturini Motorsports, and having the resources of being with Toyota now is going to be huge. So I expect big things this year.
That's awesome. Who's on the hood of your car?
Icon Direct. So they're Icon. They're RV parts manufacturer out of Manitoba, Canada.
Wow, that's very cool. Amber, thanks for coming out, and I hope you come back again.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
And we'll talk soon, okay?
Sounds good.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
Hi, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis, a Catholic priest, martial artist, and host of the Karate Priest Podcast. Have you ever wondered what the Church teaches about different topics? Are you a martial arts enthusiast or just someone who wants to learn more about martial arts? I'd like to invite you to join me and many guests on my podcast as we cover topics of faith, everyday living, and martial arts on the Karate Priest Podcast.
I'm Amber Rose, the religious hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.